This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
At the end of January, Kobe Bryant's untimely death set off a chain of events that reached into the world of media and journalism. Hours after the basketball player died in a helicopter crash, Washington Post journalist Felicia Sanmez tweeted an article about Bryant's sexual assault case from the early 2000s. Sanmez herself had been open in the past about her own experience as a sexual assault survivor. Soon after she tweeted the article, the vitriol began. Twitter users threatened her life and called her vicious names. Sanmez posted a follow-up tweet in which she screenshotted her email inbox to show just some of the hate mail she'd received. In response, the Washington Post suspended Sanmez, alleging that her tweets were, quote, hurting this institution. After many criticized the newspaper for the move, including many of her own colleagues, the Post backtracked and told her she was allowed to return to work. Many working in journalism are expected not to share thoughts or ideas that could harm the perception of objectivity for their parent organization. Even right here at New York Public Radio, home of The Takeaway, our editorial guidelines restrict producers, editors, and hosts from voicing political opinions on social media. To round out our show today, we'll look at these sorts of guidelines and the murky objectivity waters that journalists have to navigate in today's media landscape. Adam Johnson is the host of the Citations Needed podcast and columnist at theappeal.org. Adam, thanks for being back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And Alex Neeson is a writer with the Columbia Journalism Review. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
All right, Alex, I want to start with you. What were your immediate thoughts on the suspension and then the repeal by the Washington Post?
It reminded me of a conversation that I had last year with a reporter, Lewis Raven Wallace, who's got a great book out called The View from Somewhere and hosts a podcast of the same name.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with him about his book and notions of objectivity in journalism. And he said something to me at the time that immediately came to mind, where he talked about the sort of impulse of newsrooms to appear objective as opposed to helping readers and our colleagues, our other reporters that we work with, sort of understand what it means and what we do to be fair in our reporting. And I sort of, it reminded me of the sort of overcorrections that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years in response to a lot of things, threats from the Trump administration on the credibility of newsrooms, this sort of, you know, post-truth, post-fact environment that we exist in. And immediately this struck me as sort of, you know, having fallen under an umbrella of overreactions, I think, that we've seen over and over again, mistakes that we've been making.
Well, Adam, do you think Felicia was thrown under the bus?
Yeah. I mean, let's be clear here. The only reason anyone was upset at her is that she was speaking a plain truth about an extremely popular sports figure. And if you've ever spent 5 minutes listening to AM radio, you know that they're not the most rational and objective bunch of fans, right? So she muddied up a very clean narrative that the media wanted, and that it had nothing to do with any kind of neutral or objective standard of editorializing or diminishing the legacy of someone who just passed. We do this all the time, right? I mean, if a controversial figure dies, and you say something controversial about their past, or you sort of mention something that complicates it, it's not as if people get suspended for that. They got suspended because there's a bit of a heckler's veto here, right? It's if their criteria for what is out of bounds largely correlates, I suspect, with how much emails and how many phone calls they get.
And this isn't the first time this has happened with the Washington Post, correct, Adam?
No, they did this to according to the Daily Beast, they did this to Wes Lowery too, who was criticizing the New York Times coverage of racism in the Tea Party.
And what do we know about what happened with that? Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not familiar with the intimate details, but this is something that doesn't surprise me because this was also a case where you sort of went after another official sort of big media outlet, which is something you're sort of not really supposed to do and is seen as being overly editorializing. But again, I want to stress that this happens all the time anyway, right? And this is something I think people need to understand. It's giving opinions and editorializing and promoting certain ideological perspective happens all the time. The only time it's ever a problem is when either A, you do what Lowery did, where you sort of offend someone in the club, right? Or you you don't just mindlessly venerate the people everyone agrees is supposed to be mindlessly venerated. So, for example, you know, Jake Tapper and, well, pretty much the whole of media when John McCain died, it was similar to what they do when the Queen dies in England. It was a three-day hagiography fest, right, where we all gushed about how great John McCain is. Now, which John McCain, of course, was one of the primary pushers of the war in Iraq that killed 500,000 to 1 million people. He was one of the biggest defenders of Saudi Arabia in the Senate, which was and defended its war against Yemen that killed upwards of 30,000 to 50,000, possibly more people. But that's not seen as being ideological. So, you know, Jake Tapper can go on CNN. This was right before McCain's death. And after Donald Trump sort of offended him by not acknowledging him when the NDAA bill passed, and he personally thanked and apologized to John McCain. These are editorial decisions. These are opinion decisions. But because it falls within the narrow framework of what's acceptable opinion, nobody really cares, right? The problem with what Felicia did is that she sort of went outside of that range of acceptable opinions, and so the standard is totally arbitrary.
Alex, I mean, this is something that seems like a wasted opportunity on the part of the Washington Post, a journalist who is basically identifying with or making it clear that she is a survivor of sexual assault. They could have really taken advantage of her perspective and her life experience rather than shut her down, correct?
Yeah, I think it's an example of the sort of superficial ways in which we suggest that we really do value diversity amongst our staff of experience, of identity. And then when it comes down to it, we sort of cave away from that. We back off from that. And so we want people to be in the room, but we don't want them to speak when it's inconvenient. And we don't want them to speak when it upsets particular portions of our readership, I think. And then it creates, in the view of some folks, it creates problems that they just would rather not deal with, I think.
We were speaking earlier about the incident of Wesley Lowery, who had on Twitter criticized a series of articles about the Tea Party Revolution and noted that, in his words, it was essentially a hysterical grassroots tantrum about the fact that a black guy was president and how the Times hadn't included that context. After the furor over what he said, or tweeted rather, he made it a point to say, "Should go without saying, reporters of color shouldn't have their jobs threatened for speaking out about mainstream media failures to properly cover and contextualize issues of race. What's the point of bringing diverse experiences and voices into a room only to muzzle them?" Alex, your thoughts on what he tweeted?
I think he's absolutely right. There's a sort of suggestion that when we talk about our personal experiences, when we bring those into the newsroom, that this somehow sullies our ability to report fairly, that I think is just extremely misguided and sort of outdated. And I think in the last several years in particular, you've started to see this conversation come up over and over again. It inspires a lot of debate. People don't agree on this all of the time. But I think the suggestion that we can move through the world and we can move through our newsrooms while shedding every single portion of our identity is just a fantasy. We all move through the world. We all have perspectives. I think what we see is that there are particular people who are asked to do that. And there are other folks for whom we assume that that's already done, right? So the people that we are seeing being criticized for potential bias are people of color, are women, are people from marginalized communities. And there's still this sort of prevailing baseline assumption that, like, white men, for example, are never asked, you know, whether they can report on other men or on other white people in an impartial way. We're always asking people from marginalized communities who are also still sorely underrepresented in our newsrooms. We're always asking them whether they can come to this job and do this job in the way that is fair and good.
Adam, are there good counterexamples in your mind, incidents where a line was crossed and the news organization was, I guess, right to be skeptical or to kind of crack down on a journalist who went too far, perhaps?
None that I can think of, because I think the framing shouldn't be, are you objective, which is, I think, a kind of a bourgeois myth. I think the question is, are you being fair? Mm. And are you being factually accurate? And so if a reporter, let's say, I don't know, tweets out that Elvis is still alive or something sort of factually, objectively not true, that seems reasonable to sanction that. But anything that involves, you know, factually based, opinion, I think is totally fine, because the issue is not some view from nowhere. The issue is, are you being reasonable? Are you being fair? And are you accurately representing the world? And I think that this idea that, that journalists can't have opinions is, again, I think an inherently conservative idea, because if the default narrative is not seen as being subjective, right? Because we're fish in the water of ideology. That sort of prevailing ideology is not seen as being, and as Alex mentioned, is a sort of default assumption that you're not supposed to bring up rape, for example, is a product of misogyny. It has no objective basis, and that's seen as so when Kobe Bryant dies and everyone uniformly praises him, that's not seen as being ideological or opinionated. But of course it is, and so I think what we need to do is understand that these platitudes about objectivity largely exist to preserve existing ideology and power structures. They don't have any real objective or kind of neutral basis.
And Alex, a lot of this has to do with the changes to the industry, right? You have the sort of the voices of color, queer voices, voices of women who are speaking truth to power about Me Too or other issues. This is really, I guess, posing kind of a quandary for the industry that has largely been male and white for as long as America has been around, right?
Yeah, but I think that in some ways the debate that this inspires in a lot of ways is ahistorical. I think that if you consider mainstream news, then perhaps this is what you might call a new conversation. But there's a rich, long history of journalistic outlets from different communities that have always done this. The Black Press, for example, before emancipation was doing this. And today, we wouldn't question whether a reporter working for a Black newspaper in the 1800s and advocating openly for human and civil rights for Black people, today we would not question whether that was, you know, good or bad or beyond the lines of what we are allowed or supposed to do as journalists. And I think, and so in some ways, this conversation doesn't reflect that history. And this is true for other communities of color. This is true of reporters from the queer community who have always done this because we've had to. And so when we talk about this like it's something new, like it's a product of like our modern social media era, it just doesn't reflect the history of journalism. And it also reminds us that there are entire segments of journalistic history that have been literally written out of, popular conceptions of what American journalism is in particular.
And Adam, to my mind, it seems like part of this has to do with the demographic change we're seeing. We're seeing more voices of color and demographic changes happening in newsrooms, but the leadership still is very slow to change, isn't it?
Yeah, because again, I think that a lot of it comes down to sort of who they're getting. Well, it's their own biases, right? Obviously. And if it's largely white, male, more conservative, you're obviously going to those belief sets are going to be seen as default and obvious. But I also think it has a lot to do with how public relations works and how they get flack. And so, for example, if I go on social media and I say that, if I make the sort of banal national security claim that Iran is the greatest exporter of terror, you're not going to get any flack for that because it's sort of seen as being obvious. But if I go on there and say, the U.S. military is an exporter of terrorism, or the U.S. military is sort of uniquely violent and sinister, I'm going to get a lot of flack from that, from the sort of, think tank crowd, from the Pentagon itself. And so you have this asymmetry of how public relations works. And I think that creates a problem where, you see this with bail reform coverage right now, which I cover at The Appeal in New York City. You have this constant racial demagoguery over bail reform, New York Daily News putting these very racialized kind of Willie Horton mugshots up. And this constituency, we obviously have some African-American groups who can sort of complain, but they're not that powerful. And the people in the newsrooms don't reflect that constituency. And so you can sort of go along and smear these vulnerable communities pretty much all you want, because there's no public relations firm for these people. It's the same. It's like with homeless. You can sort of smear the homeless all you want because there's no public relations firm who's going to call and complain.
Yes.
So I really think the power asymmetry and the lack of understanding of that power asymmetry exposes this idea of objectivity as again, I think, a total power-flattering myth.
Adam Johnson is the host of the Citations Needed podcast and columnist at theappeal.org, and Alex Neeson is a writer with the Columbia Journalism Review. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.